Elizabeth West, author of African Spirituality and Black Women's Fiction, Threaded Visions of Memory, Community, Nature, and Being, published by Lexington Books in 2011, is this week's featured author on New Books in African American Studies, the interview series where writers of African American life, arts, culture, and sciences discuss their new books. I'm your host, Vershawn Young, and I enjoyed learning all about the African spirituality in the works of the late 18th century poet Phyllis Wheatley, all the way through the works of Zora Neale Hurston during the Harlem Renaissance and beyond. I'm sure you'll enjoy this lively exchange with Elizabeth West as well. Listen in.
Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello, Vershawn. It's good to be talking to you today.
Thank you, and welcome to New Books in African American Studies. Today, we're speaking with Elizabeth J. West, and she's the author of African Spirituality in Black Women's Fiction, Threaded Visions of Memory, Community, Nature, and Being, published by Lexington Books in 2011. Elizabeth's book examines African spirituality and Black women's writing from Phyllis Wheatley to Zora Neale Hurston. And in between these two authors' texts, she includes the study of such authors as Harriet Wilson and Elizabeth Keckley in what is called their novelized autobiographies. We're so delighted to have Elizabeth on the show today. Elizabeth, can you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm currently at Georgia State University as an associate professor, where I've been for a while, 11 years now, and I'm a kind of a dual rooted person in terms of experience. I've been in academia probably half of my professional life, and came there from private industry, where I spent as many years. So I, in this half of my professional life, I'm having the opportunity to get paid to pursue the kind of questions I had when I, you know, when I worked in private industry and didn't have that kind of time.
And can you tell us what brought you to write African spirituality and Black women's fiction?
Well, to answer that question, I'm going to borrow from a book talk that I gave last month at the Auburn Library here in Atlanta. You know, as academics do, I felt like I had to have a title to give me some direction, and I called that book talk Yes, the Personal is Political and Intellectual as Well. And I came up with that title because I wanted to, in that talk, and because I knew people would have, you know, that kind of question, I wanted to talk about the origins of this project. You know, so many times we want to talk about what we do in academia as if it is clearly disconnected from, you know, who we are personally, what our, you know, our personal orientation is. And I think it's useful, though, to, you know, to counter that paradigm or that myth, because we're all informed by, you know, by the personal, by our own experiences and our own lens.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book project, you know, came about as you know, my interest in African American literature as a student, and in particular early African American literature, where class after class and conference after conferences later, where I would read and hear people talk about early Black fiction or, you know, creative writing, and talk about the issue of or the matter of religion and spirituality in a way that suggested that Africans in the New World, in terms of their religious orientation, you know, that it began for them once they, you know, put a foot on the shores in the New World. You know, this kind of suggestion that Christianity became the beginning, was the beginning of African American spirituality. And I knew from my own personal kinds of experiences that there were all kinds of contradictions that I noticed as a child growing up in the Black church. You know, you get this, understanding, clear understanding of you know, what constitutes Christianity. You get that in writing and, you know, and in all the doctrine, but then you attend church and you see things going on that don't quite fit into this paradigm of Western Christianity. And you know, what I realize is that Black people live this duality. And for the most part, don't question it, but just accept it. And as you know, so as I, you know, studied and read and wrote more about early African American works, and in particular women's works, I became struck by certain threads that I felt were evident, you know, throughout these works, and I saw them eventually as tying to a kind of spiritual origins, and that origin extending across the Atlantic to continental Africa.
Wow, that's fascinating. Let's jump right into that topic, because you cite other authors, other scholars who have noticed a connection, a spiritual connection in Black women's fiction. One such critic is Ann Dalk.
Uh-huh.
But you're taking the study farther back than Doc does in her work, right?
Yes. And a different perspective, because her work is, you know, it's briefer in terms of its look, and it's also more of a sociological kind of look, you know, whereas mine is, you know, extends to the literary tradition.
And one passage that you cite from her work cites familiar authors to, I suppose, our listeners, Toni Morrison's Beloved, Alice Walker's The Color Purple, Toni K. Bambaro's The Salt Eaters, and one work that you do deal with in your book, which is Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God. Can you talk a little bit first about the African spirituality that's present in contemporary Black women's fiction?
Well, what I see in contemporary, in fact, is what inspired me to do this work and to look back to the early works. Because in reading the works of authors such as Toni, Toni Morrison and Gloria Naylor, for instance, I saw these threads that were consistent in these works, and particularly, for instance, the central place of memory in these works. And in fact, if you went to any kind of, you know, online search engine for Toni Morrison, you would just be flooded with scholarship that looks at memory in Morrison's work. So scholars recognize the importance of memory, remembering, in the works of Toni Morrison, and in particular, for instance, if you think about Beloved, to make Setha whole and healthy again, it is a process of community memory that remembering that must take place, and that's this ritual that happens at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, this is more than, you know, just, you know, a kind of isolated, you know, practice that Morrison captures here. You know, it in fact, again, represents the central place of memory and community in the spiritual sensibilities of Africans, you know, in the New World and on the continent. And so it was, you know, in the reading of these contemporary works and the scholarship on these works, that inspired me to, you know, to look at the earlier works, because my, you know, my focus is for the, you know, the greater part of my work is focuses on early African American writers. And what disturbed me so often was how these early writers were dismissed, you know, in terms of their connections to a kind of African origin. Scholars typically just dismissed them as you know, these kind of mockingbirds for New World Christianity. You know, with the implication that they, you know, they looked away from Africa, you know, both deliberately, you know, and unconsciously. And I kept seeing these resonances of, you know, of Morrison and, you know, and, you know, and Naylor and Walker in these early works. And this is the, you know, what inspired me to make the connection, to do more than just to look at how we see this in these contemporary works. And again, with a kind of suggestion that it's only through this kind of conscious, creative, you know, machination of African female writers in the 20th and 21st century that we see this, that it just kind of spontaneously generates. And my position was, no, these women in the 20th century, 21st century, they are capturing something that is inherent in the culture of African people in the New World. You know, something that you might even call a cultural or historical DNA even, you know, something that was there and transferred over early with, you know, initially with African people, and that you can see this then in the early works, particularly of African American women.
And in fact, your book does something that every skillful researcher needs to do. You went back to the beginning in order to look at the works of Phyllis Wheatley, who your book says critics subjected to that claim of a kind of disconnection from Africa, but you reclaimed the African spirituality in her work. Can you talk about that first chapter, I'm sorry, that second chapter about Phyllis Wheatley?
Yes, this actually was represents a kind of awakening, intellectual awakening of my own, because as a student, when I first encountered Wheatley, I for the most part appropriated the, you know, the kind of standard reactions that students and scholars have had to her work. And that is to give it this surface reading and see it as merely, you know, this young, you know, African woman brought here as a slave and brainwashed early and could only see the world through the, you know, the white puritanical lens of her masters. And at some point, and I think it was probably when I was in graduate school, I revisited Wheatley and started to consider more seriously, you know, the milieu in which Wheatley is writing.
Mm-hmm.
And it just started to occur to me that this was a young woman who was just exceptional. She was clever. She was shrewd. And that she was doing what, you know, what so many black writers would do after her, and that is to couch meaning, to couch resistance in what seems to be the, you know, a language of acquiescence.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us a specific example of when you think she does that? In one of her poetry, perhaps in one of her poems, perhaps in On Being Brought from Africa to America?
Yeah, that is, in fact, that's the poem that I teach most often in both American and African American literature classes, because students tend to read it and just, you know, have knee-jerk reactions to it. And again, that's because if you read it just on the surface, it does seem to be, incredibly self-denigrating poem. But when you read the poem and you consider the images, the symbols at play, and it's such a brief poem too, which makes it so much more remarkable, you really begin then to appreciate Wheatley's genius, because it's if I remember right, it's like an 8-line poem, and in that short poem, she kind of has you on the hook until she gets you to the last two lines, mm-hmm. and by on the hook I mean she seems to, in the first lines of the poem, she seems to be playing to, you know, the kind of standard white rhetoric of African primitivism, and subhumanity. In those first few lines, in which she describes, being brought from a pagan land and, coming to understand God, through being, brought to America. And so in those first few lines, there seems to just be, again, this incredible giving over of her humanity. But the twist comes in the last two lines. And you have to look carefully at the italics as well as the language itself. You know, that in the last two lines, she begins with the word remember, almost in a command kind of tone. You know, the very tone of the poem itself shifts when she gets to that second to the last line. And in that second to the last line, she takes us to the biblical Cain, and you know, Cain is used in Western religious rhetoric at this time to justify the enslavement of Africans, mm-hmm. And that is this interpretation of Cain as, after having sinned, being marked by God, being written off. And this was the often used explanation for African enslavery and, enslavement in the New World. And so much so that oftentimes blacks themselves would recite this as the reading of Genesis. But what Wheatley makes evident in this poem is that while she has heard this story as it's been told to her, that she in fact has gone to the source, that the text itself, and read it in its entirety, and understands that while Cain was first damned by God, in the end, not only did God redeem Cain, but promised Cain, protection, in the ages to come. And so it's Wheatley's way then of saying the African in terms of redemption is no different than anyone else. Mm-hmm. He sins, but God, God looks at him, rejects him at some point, but that, God is forgiving and redemptive, and that this is the story of Cain and thus the story of Africans as well.
Wow. Incisive analysis. Excellent. Overall, the book deals with what we call, literary works in terms of Wheatley's poetry and novels, short stories, etc. But in the chapter that follows your discussion of Wheatley, you deal with rhetorical works. You deal with preachers. Can you tell us about that choice and why that's important at this time period?
I think to go to these early black women, preachers and religious figures is central in a discussion of African American women's writing, whether creative or nonfiction, because they represent, you know, a kind of beginnings, origins for both areas of African American women's writing. You get the emergence of African American women's fiction around the, you know, the middle of the 19th century, but before then, you have an abundance of, you know, of work, of writings by nonfiction writings by African American women. And what you see exemplified in these works, and, you know, in the terms of the kinds of symbols and images and tropes and voice, you know, that they will appropriate, these are then, you know, transformed into, you know, into the literary fiction as well. So I think it's central to begin with, you know, with these nonfiction writers.
Now, one of the most familiar to probably our listeners is Mariah Stewart, but you deal with Rebecca Cox, Jerina Lee. How do they compare to Stewart?
I think in my mind they I see them as more revealing in terms of the kind of obvious connections you can draw in their work to an African spiritual origins. Stewart is tied to tied to the early Black church in a way that I think is represents a greater struggle for her than I think Lee and Jackson even. And so Stewart's works, oftentimes, I think, resonate more with a kind of church patriarchal rooting than you know, than the works of Lee and Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, in spite of that, in you know, among the three, you know, as I talk about in the book, there are still these kind of obvious, you know, presumptions in their, not only in their work, but in the very assertion of themselves, you know, putting themselves out there as the spiritual figures that come out of again, and you know, an African sense of you know, divine inspiration, and that is that women are natural and oftentimes the choice vessels of the divine, you know, in terms of conveying you know, a spiritual, you know, messages. And so with Lee and, you know, with Lee and Jackson in their works, though, I think you see more, though, of very specific kinds of connections to African spiritual sensibilities, you know, things like nature, you know, the connection of nature and God, you know, and how nature plays into spiritual revelations.
Before we move on to the mid to late 19th century writers that you talk about in this book, I want to slow down here to ask a question about the elements of spirituality or African spirituality that you codify in the book that a reader could discern in these works. You've already referenced the role of memory, but there are others that you cite that are inherent to African spirituality.
Memory I start with as you know, kind of central, and I talk about how we you know, how we again see that in pre Middle Passage experience among African people. memory, community. Community again is this other element of Africana culture to the present that you know that we see pervasive you know in the culture of African people and again so much so that we see it in scholarship on African works as a prevailing topic. So memory, community. And then the matter of nature, and that is nature, both animate and inanimate, and how that you know how that then informs you know an African sensibility about the spiritual that again very much contrasts Christianity in which there's this presumption that religion is this relationship between God and man, whereas a more African rooted sensibility sees God in all of our existence, animate and inanimate. So again, that it is the sense of nature as very much a part of human spiritual experience, and then finally, this belief in the interconnectedness of worldly and otherworldly beings, that is the sense that. Among African people, that the living, the fortunes of the living, are very much tied to the other world, and that's how you see this kind of interplay of these other concepts as well, because you know, other world meaning. The ancestors who have passed, and that ties to the sense of memory, so that it becomes central to the culture that memory always must play a part of the spiritual. The ancestors must be remembered. That is how you get the blessings in your life in the carnal world.
I have another question for you that struck me after I finished reading the book, and that is about the comparison or the contrast between the antebellum women writers that you study and the postbellum writers. Is there a difference between in the way in which they represent and feature African spirituality?
I think what we find in the antebellum writings is this kind of giving over of all that is African to a Western assessment of race, particularly Africanity. So what we see in these works, at least ostensibly, is this rejection, rejection of all that is connected to an African past. So Christianity is appropriated because it is then associated with civilization and with humanity human existence that is of any worth. And so in these antebellum writings you see women writers, who, if they address an evident African presence in their works, they will deal with it in the work in a way, again, that resonates with the kind of Western sensibility about, you know, blackness and Africanity associated with a kind of subhumanity.
Do you think that there is a more significant presence in the more autobiographical works, such as Keckley's memoir or Wilson's Our Nig or Harriet Jacobs' Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, as opposed to, let's say, the not too far off, but latter works of Harper's Iola Leroy or Hopkins' Contending Forces?
I think it is much more prevalent in the later works, the later 19th century works, Harper and Hopkins in particular. You know, when we get to Harper and Hopkins, we aren't at that point again where African women writers are willing to see Africa as worthy, as human. But they are willing to, connect to in subtle kind of ways, connect Africans in the New World more clearly to an African past. And in particular in Hopkins, I think Hopkins is in Contending Forces is one of those works that I think most humorously make the point. I think I have most fun when I think about that chapter and when I teach teaching Contending Forces, because Hopkins really starts to kind of you see this kind of subversiveness at play in Hopkins' work in terms of challenging this notion that Western Christianity represents this kind of authoritative and final voice on real or true Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you mind if I ask you a somewhat possibly contentious question about one of your Harlem Renaissance authors, Jesse Fawcett?
Uh-huh. No, not at all.
I'm wondering, and I was wondering as I read the book, and I have in the margins around pages 130 through 137, where you're discussing Fawcett's There Is Confusion. And her protagonist, Joanna, and I'm wondering if your reading, if you would say that your reading is one that Fawcett herself would agree with. Not that means that it's wrong, and that's not what I'm suggesting. I mean, in terms of bringing out the African spirituality in the text.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and actually, I think your question is so important for just that reason, and that is to not give the impression that in this book I'm trying to suggest that there is some kind of continued conscious thread at play, because this is, I think, what is most exciting about the read of these works that I'm giving, and that is that these are things at play in these concepts and paradigms of Africanity are at play in these works, whether the authors meant them or not.
Mm.
And in most cases, I think with the exception of Hurston, in fact, I think you could probably argue that they didn't mean to.
Okay. And what about, I'm going to ask you about how the ending of Nella Larsen's Quicksand coheres with, I'm struggling to formulate this question because it just just came to me actually, coheres with a spiritual presence in the novel. It seems that critics would argue that lack of vision or the seeming future for Angela in this text, at the end of the text at least, is demoralizing in some ways.
It is, and in fact, that's the point I'm getting at in that look at Larson's text, and the emphasis on Larson's text, in fact, is not to make the case of African spirituality at work in her text, but actually to demonstrate this clear rejection of Christianity that becomes prevalent in Harlem Renaissance women's writings. What quicksand gives us in terms of Christianity, I think, is without a doubt a rejection. Christianity can't save. It does not save the protagonist, and in what is suggested in the title itself, quicksand.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is tantamount to what Christianity does to the heroine. It just sucks her in and sucks the very life out of her. But the emphasis is though that what happens in Larson's text though is while she rejects, the text does not play to this kind of typical representation of Christianity as an awakening and concurrent with the awakening of the protagonist. That rather than that, again, Christianity doesn't function alongside of a kind of narrative of awakening. But what Larson does alternatively is that she suggests then that, yes, we can still see these elements of Africanity in African people in the New World, but the importance of quicksand in that respect, though, is that what she suggests is that a kind of hope of looking to Africa as salvation or redemption or enlightenment is futile as well.
Right, right. You know what? Thank you for that clarification. Thank you so much. That's really important to how I'm understanding what I read. I think I probably missed that point because I was focusing on what seemed to be a suggested transformation in that text. In Angela's life, but you just clarified it for me, so thank you. Would you mind reading a passage for us?
Certainly. I think what I'll do is go to the section on Hurston, and I'll read the section from the section that looks at Hurston's novel Jonas Gourdvine.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll try to shorten it, but I want to give enough of it to give a sense of the argument that I'm making here, because I think with this passage it helps to give a real sense of where the book takes us at the end. So I'll begin on page 154. John is a big voice. He is divinely inspired. While he does not realize his gift until he reaches manhood, his almost mystical return to his homeland hints at the destiny that awaits him. Not long after John's arrival, he battles a fearsome snake that lurks along a path frequently traveled by Lucy and others in the community. John's encounter with the serpent that strikes fear in the community portends his spiritual greatness. Lucy describes the snake as cunning and frightening. She tells John, quote, He got a hole back under the bank where you can see him, but you can't get him, though. Though you was down in the branch, he lay all round there on the ground and even on the foot log. But when he see somebody coming, he go in his hole all ready for you to, for you and lay there and dare you to bother him. When John kills this dreaded creature, Lucy is ecstatic. Ooh, John, I'm so glad you killed that old devil. He been right there scaring folks since before I was born. Lucy's paradoxical awe and fear of the snake symbolizes its dual legacy in African American culture. Her awe of the snake reminds us of its place of reverence in traditional African societies. Her view of the snake as demonic represents the influence of Christianity's representation of the snake in the Garden of Eden. With its transformed image as demon in African American culture, the human who has power over the snake is then considered one who holds supernatural ability. John's triumph over the snake seems to suggest that he is divinely empowered. But if we consider Lucy's description of the snake, perhaps John's conquest is more accurately read as the signal of his ultimate doom. While Lucy tells John that the snake strikes fear in all of the community, she reports that he retreats when others approach, daring them to disturb his ground. According to Lucy, the snake predates her. He is legendary. Though she reports that the snake is threatening, she does not indicate that the snake has ever harmed anyone. The community has lived in a long-standing truce with the snake. They fear and revere it, but they accept its place among them. The snake comes among them, but they know that they are not allowed in the snake's refuge. John disturbs this balance with his aggressive pursuit and slaying of the creature. He has broken the cycle. And while Lucy celebrates his momentary victory, John ultimately cannot find peace or balance in his life.
Very important section. Can you tell us how you imagine your book being taught? What kinds of courses and what kind of curriculum setting?
I see it as a book most useful in upper division and graduate level courses that you know have a particular emphasis in, let's say, women's literature, African American literature, literature and religion, you know, literature and spirituality.
Oh, nice! And what are you working on now?
I have this longstanding interest in Ethiopianism in early African American writings, and so I'm beginning to kind of outline a study that will look at this what really becomes this tradition of Ethiopianism in, you know, nonfiction as well as fiction in early African-American works.
Thank you, Elizabeth West, for joining us on New Books in African-American Studies.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
I hope you've enjoyed this discussion with Elizabeth West about her new provocative book, African Spirituality in Black Women's Fiction, Threaded Visions of Memory, Community, Nature, and Being, published by Lexington Books in 2011. Even if you are not an African-American literary critic or cultural critic, if you are an everyday reader, I'm sure you will enjoy this book as well. It's quite informative. Get your copy today.